I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 2nd of July. Solutions. American leaders speak out on criminal justice reform. The country's most prominent public figures and experts propose ideas for change. That's a book we talk about this hour. It's a series of original essays. The vast majority of those writing essays agree that reducing our incarcerated population is a priority, and it marks a shift on crime and punishment in America, from using federal funding to bolster police best practices to allowing for the release of low-level offenders while they wait for trial, eliminating prison for low-level drug crimes to increasing drug and mental health treatment. These are some of the ideas in the book, and joining us to talk about the book is the person who put it all together and has a piece in this book herself. Inamai Chetiyar is our guest, director of the Brennan Center's Justice Program, which seeks to secure our nation's promise of equal justice for all by creating an effective, rational, and fair legal system. She worked at the ACLU before going to Brennan. She was a lead architect of their nationwide initiative to end mass incarceration. She's a lawyer, and we are going to welcome phone calls for Inamai. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Inamai, hello. Thank you very much for being with us, and what an interesting compilation of essays this is.
Thanks so much for having me, Kathleen.
It's interesting that we have not, as the former President Bill Clinton reminds us early in this book, had a complete assessment of where the criminal justice system is now. In 1994, we had a very different situation. We had a move to incarcerate many, many people, and everybody pretty much agreed with that. Now we are, in many states, having a call, bipartisan call, for something different. Why now?
You know, it's really quite interesting what's been happening. So I think that the fact that the crime rate has been cut in half since 1990 has really opened up the space for us to be able to have a rational conversation about our crime policies. Now, in the 90s, when the crime was very high, a lot of laws were enacted on the instinct or guess that they were going to reduce crime. And what actually it produced instead is this phenomenon of mass incarceration, where we now have 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. And what's happened now is not only are, you know, people starting to agree in terms of researchers and academics, but actually politicians are beginning to agree. And not only Democrats, but this has largely been driven by Republicans. And so it's a really kind of unprecedented, very unique political situation on this particular issue.
And is a large part of it the fact that this costs, this mass incarceration, $260 billion a year?
Yes, absolutely. So what's happened is that, you know, for various reasons, moral reasons, fiscal reasons, economic reasons, religious reasons, both parties have really come to see that this is a waste of government dollars because we're not actually getting the public safety that we think we should be getting for spending that much money.
President Bill Clinton, in the foreword to the book, says that some people now are in prison who shouldn't be, others for too long and without a plan to educate, train, and reintegrate them into our communities. And a large number of people do reintegrate into our communities. Who is in prison? Would you agree with this, that some are in prison who shouldn't be? And if so, who are those people?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that there are three drivers of the mass incarceration problem, and President Clinton has there identified two. So one is that there are people in prison who do not need to be there. The second, that even the people who are in prison are going there for too long. And the third is that we are selectively enforcing our policies on particular communities. And so in terms of who does not need to be in prison, so There are about, I would say, half of federal prisoners and half of state prisoners are there for nonviolent and drug crimes. And so a vast majority of those people, even if we agree that they should still be, the activity should still be criminalized, and even if we agree that the activity should still be punished, there is not a reason for them to actually be incarcerated, which is, you know, the harshest legal punishment short of death. And so I think that a lot of those people could definitely be released while still maintaining public safety. The other issue really is our jail system. And so we have a tremendous amount of people who are sitting in prison simply awaiting trials, and they have not been convicted of any crime, and they are also low risk. And so those folks can also get released safely.
And the people who are in for drug-related, nonviolent drug crimes, it would appear to me as though we need to spend, I don't know how much money, if we're spending a lot now, to have those people treated so they don't commit more crimes because of their drug habits.
Right. So what's interesting is that prison is 10 times more expensive than treatment, so that we could actually give people who needed drug and mental health treatment the treatment they needed, keep them out of prison, and actually also then reduce crime. So it actually would be a win-win for those people and for society to send them to treatment instead of prison.
Cory Booker reminds us in an essay, the senator from New Jersey, that more than 60% of the prison population is comprised of racial and ethnic minorities.
Yeah, I mean, this is one very large problem with mass incarceration, is that it's having an effect on particularly communities of color. So we actually just released a report last week on racial disparities in the criminal justice system, and what we have found there is that a lot of times the reason that people of color end up in the criminal justice system is not necessarily overt racism, but often implicit bias and implicit kind of subconscious decisions and actions that people are taking that lead more people of prison, more people of color to prison. Because the data show that people of color and white people actually commit crimes at the same rate, though people of color are arrested, prosecuted, and incarcerated more frequently.
Mm-hmm. What was interesting to me was the number of people of all political persuasions who seem to agree. There seems to be just bipartisan agreement on this, looking at what to do with nonviolent drug crimes, that most people would agree that we simply can't do that anymore.
Yeah, no, I think that definitely, there is now, I would say, a national consensus starting to build that for nonviolent drug crimes, we do not need to be using prison. And I think that is one definite starting point for reducing mass incarceration.
Because we've heard so much talk lately, and you've done reports on this as well, Inamai, what about this issue of racial profiling? Cornell William Brooks from the NAACP, the president, talked about that in his essay, Racial Profiling, Harming Black and Brown Communities at Both Ends of the Criminal Justice System. Was that mentioned by many of the 22 prominent Americans who submitted essays?
Yeah, so several people talked about race. So Vice President Biden in his essay speaks about race. Secretary Clinton speaks about race. Martin O'Malley, Mike Huckabee, and actually Rand Paul as well all talk about race. What I actually think is quite fascinating is that there is an emerging consensus that we need to reduce incarceration. But if you move to policing and racial profiling and police tactics, there is actually still disagreement among people in terms of whether and how to reform policing and profiling.
Mm-hmm. Vice President Biden reminded us, and I remember these days, of community policing, which was a big phrase here in Milwaukee some years ago, and he helped institutionalize that in 1994. He says when it started, it worked, but it is really expensive. It takes a lot of cops.
Yeah, you know, so that bill in 1994, this is the crime bill that was championed not only by Vice President Biden, but also President Clinton, and many Democrats and Republicans at that time. That bill dramatically helped increase incarceration. So what it did is it gave $9 billion to states to increase their prison population. So it was one of the contributing factors to mass incarceration. But at the same time, what it also did was put 100,000 more police officers on the streets and to increase the practice of community policing. So we now, you know, see the fallout from that bill, that there were many positive effects in terms of how it did bring down crime, it did improve community policing, but then we had this also inadvertent consequence of mass incarceration.
In my what has happened, I remember this three strikes, you're out was a prominent philosophy for incarceration some years ago. Whatever happened to three strikes, you're out?
So three strikes, you're out has been passed in many states across the country. A lot of them have two strikes, you're out. They have four strikes, you're out. I mean, basically what's happening with those laws is even if you have committed fairly low-level crimes, but you are considered a repeat offender, that then there is a mandatory, not only incarceration, but a mandatory length of incarceration as well. So you are sent off to prison, even if it's three or four very petty crimes. And I think now, in retrospect, a lot of people are realizing that that is not a smart way to deal with crime, and that quite frequently we actually need rehabilitation and services and other types of programs instead of prison. And that what's happening is when you put very low-level people in prison, you know, it's a very well-documented effect that they actually come out committing more crimes. And so three strikes in many ways, I think, has actually been very counterproductive.
Have some states done away with it?
There are efforts in states to modify three strikes. So there was a big effort in California to change the type of crime that would trigger their law there. And so many states are now looking at how to kind of reverse this trend, particularly with three strikes, also with mandatory minimums, reducing the mandatory minimum sentences, and reversing another type of law called truth in sentencing, which forces prisoners to serve very long sentences.
You remind us in your essay that the average prison stay increased, this is huge, 36% since 1990.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's you know, the problem is not only who we are putting in prison, but for how long we are putting them there. So they're actually serving more time now for the exact same crime, and we know that the length of stay in prison doesn't affect your recidivism rate, right? So that if you're sending someone to prison for, you know, 3 years, 5 years, and then you start increasing it to 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, those additional years don't have that much of an effect in terms of reducing recidivism rate. So.
If you make treatment and not prison the standard response for people with mental health or addiction issues, it would seem to me as though, if we're talking about money being a major concern in many states in this country, this kind of treatment, rehabilitation, might be very expensive, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so, you know, the providing treatment and providing rehabilitation is almost always cheaper than prison. So prison can cost anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000 a year. Treatment costs significantly less, and treatment is significantly more effective. And so if we actually switch the default, and if people were identified as needing mental health treatment or drug treatment, and they went to, you know, treatment instead of prison, not only would we save money, but we would reduce crime, and we would reduce the prison population.
We're going to welcome the audience to join and ask them to speak out on criminal justice reform. The Brennan Center has put together a very interesting book, asked some national leaders from various political persuasions to write essays on the high rate of mass incarceration in this country, the expense of that, racial profiling, a number of issues, the number of people who are in prison for nonviolent offense, frequently drug-related offenses. The authors include Joe Biden, Chris Christie, Hillary Clinton, Ted Cruz, Mike Huckabee, Martin O'Malley, Rand Paul, Scott Walker, James Webb, and others. The book is Solutions, American Leaders Speak Out on criminal justice? Do you think that we need a national conversation and really some policies that are quite different than what they are now? If you look alone at the amount of money that we've spent, it's $260 billion a year, and a lot of states say they can't afford that. Should the emphasis be on rehabilitation, on mental health services? Would you believe and agree that there are a number of people in prison right now who shouldn't be in prison and they should be getting treatment? How do we set that up? Do we need to change the system that puts people in prison for long periods of time? Are we looking at a different kind of environment than we were 30 years ago in this country when we enacted so many policies that put people in prison for long periods of time? What do you think? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, we love to read your comments there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. Do we need to take a long, hard look at our incarceration in this country, our mass incarceration and change it? 800-486-8655. We go to Jeff in Madison for our first caller for you. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Kathleen. I have a question as far as, I know Portugal had a huge drug problem, heroin specifically, and they kind of just legalized all drugs and instead of sending people to prison, they gave them treatment, and it's working as far as I know. It really cut down the amount of, you know, people being imprisoned, and, you know, it's helping addicts, you know, recover instead of going back to the drugs as well.
Are you familiar with what's going on in Portugal, Inamai?
Yes. So, that is exactly right. So what Portugal did was to change their drug policy significantly. And there have been a lot of research and reports on how they were able to kind of manage their drug use while legalizing and reducing penalties and providing treatment. So, I mean, I think that is definitely one thing that many people have advocated. In the book specifically, Rand Paul talks about a change to drug policies. I know there are actually there's still a debate, I think, about whether or not to legalize drugs. And I believe that it is Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz in the book talks very clearly about, even if there's a debate about legalizing drugs, we can all still agree that nonviolent drug offenders don't need to go to prison and instead should receive treatment.
Thanks, Jeff, very much for your call. Jim in Madison, hi.
Is this Jim driving to Madison?
I don't know if you're driving there or not, Jim.
Yes. Okay, two comments, two
sure.
Quick ones. We increased incarceration length of stay and number of people in the 90s, and our crime rates are down now. Seems to me there may be because of A, we got B, and I'd like some commentary about that. I do not have statistics, but it seems to me that's a logical conclusion. If we had more people locked up and more people locked up for longer, maybe that's a bigger deterrent, so we have less crime now.
Mm-hmm.
Second point, I disagree with the speaker and anybody else that says that drug dealing is a nonviolent crime. Drug dealing is a very violent crime, and we should be incarcerating dealers. I don't think there's a high percentage of people that are users that are locked up. Those are my comments,
okay.
And I can take them offline.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Inamai.
Sure. So the first question is a great question, and many people do make that correlation. So to provide the statistics, since 1990, the prison population has almost doubled. We've added about 1 million people to be behind bars. And at the same time, crime was cut in half. So yes, naturally people are going to think those two are, you know, they're A caused B, as the caller said. And so we actually just put out a major comprehensive report on the crime decline, looking at 14 different theories about why crime declined. And we found that incarceration was increased incarceration was responsible for about less than 10% of, you know, an almost negligible going down to zero into during the 2000s. That actually a lot of environmental factors and social factors helped bring down crime. One thing, though, that we did find is that certain policing tactics, specifically the implementation of CompStat in many different cities, did help to reduce crime. So it sounds like, you know, there are many things that the police can do to help bring down crime, but that the dramatic expansion of incarceration did very little to bring down crime.
The implementation of what did you say? CompStat. What's
that? It's a management tool that originated in New York City under Bill Bratton in the early 90s. And what it does is it basically helps police departments gather data on crime and then decide how and when to deploy police to specific high crime areas. And so it's basically a way to collect the data on crime and then deploy police resources based on data. And so, a lot of police call it a management tool or a management technique, and it was implemented in New York and then implemented in almost all major cities across the country thereafter. And so we found about I believe it was a 10 to 12% decline due to CompStat for the national crime rate.
Mm. And what about drug dealing? Is it a violent crime?
You know, so I think that there are different types of drug dealing. A lot of people who are in prison could be classified as quote-unquote drug dealers, but they were people who were selling to friends or selling to a neighbor. As as opposed to some type of drug kingpin or someone who was selling a very large volume of drugs. And so I think we do have to make a differentiation between who is someone who is addicted to drugs, who's using drugs, who's perhaps dealing in order to support their own habit, versus someone who is trying to kind of profit off of the addiction of other people.
Anita in Beaver Dam, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to say, and I know this is sort of Pollyanna to say, but I just really think we need to stop talking about profiling in arrests and incarceration as much as we're talking about illiteracy. By the time a person is an adult and is illiterate, their options to actually make an income and do things other than sell drugs is very limited. And so I really get tired of trying to split hairs over whether drugs are violent or not. Those people have done those things because their circumstances offered them very few other opportunities. So whether they were able to rise out of poverty or they fell into poverty, illiteracy is at the core of it. I mean, and so I don't know if any of the essays talk about we have to have kids learning to read in our public schools, and then we're going to have a real controversial conversation about what really needs to happen in our schools, because all kids can learn to read. Very, very few children cannot learn to read in the United States. I mean, we can do like 98% of people can learn to read.
Inima.
Yeah, no, I actually absolutely agree with that. I think that a lot of the reason that people are committing crimes is due to other circumstances such as an inability to secure an education, an ability to secure adequate employment. By some guesses, about 20% of the U.S. poverty rate is attributable to incarceration. So it's actually kind of a cycle here where the more that people are not getting the education and economic resources they need, the more crime is being committed, the more incarceration increases, which in turn then drives people further and further into this sort of prison and poverty spiral.
Can we talk a little bit about the recidivism rate now? Has it gone down? What is it? How many people are released from prison on an annual basis? How many are able to secure jobs and lives that will keep them from going back?
So there are about 600,000 people released from prison every year, and about two-thirds of people recidivate. And
two-thirds?
Yeah, and I think that this shows prison is not effective for rehabilitation. Prison is effective if you literally want to, you know, it's technically in terms of criminology, it's called like incapacitation. So if you send someone to prison, you know that they are not committing crime during the time that they are in prison. But as soon as they get out, they're not given treatment, they're not given reentry services, they're stigmatized because they have a conviction, they're formally incarcerated, they have trouble getting jobs, they have trouble reintegrating into society, and then they end up committing crimes again because there's no net, and then returning back to prison. So, I mean, I think what it's really showing is that if we are trying to, I mean, unless you are keeping someone in prison forever, it's not going to reduce, it doesn't help reduce crime once a person exits prison.
Mm-hmm. And how many prisons have effective rehabilitation programs? Are there certain states that do?
You know, most states do not have great reentry programs. One example of where a state has made large strides in this is actually the state of Texas. And Rick Terry and several other authors in the book discuss this, how what Texas did is, so instead of building more prisons, Texas decided to make a massive, this actually goes to your comment about that treatment is expensive. So Texas decided to spend money instead on treatment programs and reentry programs. And then it ended up, by doing that, it was able to cut its prison population dramatically, save a lot of money while its crime rate continued to drop. So I think that's a good example of what states can do.
Thanks so much, Anita, for your call. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Inamai Chettiar is our guest, director of the Brennan Center's Justice Program, and we're talking about their just-released, very interesting compilation of essays by American leaders of different political persuasions, Solutions, American Leaders Speak Out on Criminal Justice. Gerald in Hamburg is next. Hi, Gerald.
Hi, Kathleen. Interesting subject. I was just wondering, I've been hearing about, you know, the for-profit prisons, privately run prisons, and several of them I've heard are actually suing because they aren't getting enough prisoners. Now, I'm wondering, is there any correlation between for-profit prisons and length of incarcerations? If you have that information, it would be really interesting. And I can't wait to find this article to read all these essays. Sounds really interesting.
Thanks, Joe.
So, yeah, private prisons is definitely a challenge. So what's basically happening with private prisons, they are paid by contract with states based on the number of prison beds that they are able to fill. So private prisons have an incentive to support policies that would increase incarceration and, you know, sentence length. And actually, I don't have the information offhand about whether there has been found to be a causation, but I would not be surprised because the way that the contracts are working, they're actually incentivizing private prisons to want to support policies to help increase mass incarceration.
We go next to Adam Duluth. Hi.
Hi. I think that the conversation has been a little narrow just to nonviolent drug offenses. I mean, right now in this country, there are so many laws that most of us are breaking at least one at any given time in our day. And those laws are so broadly written, and the police have so much enforcement power that, I mean, just about any of us are subject to arrest.
Really? You think we're all doing something once a day? What are we doing?
I think, yeah, there's a lot of things. I mean, it could come down to loitering or truck tax. In Minneapolis, it's illegal to spit on the street. And all of these things, especially within the minority community, people are arrested for daily.
Inamai.
Yeah, I actually agree with the caller. I think it's either in one of the essays, I believe it's Ted Cruz's, talks about how There was a study that the average person committed about 3 crimes a day. And I think that just the fact that everything now is criminalized, that anyone can get arrested for doing something, but that the kind of law enforcement and the policing presence has been very focused on particular communities and then arresting those people when they commit those crimes. So, yes, that is absolutely a dynamic that occurs and something that helps contribute to mass incarceration.
And I believe it was Governor Chris Christie in his essay talked about people who had committed serious crimes and continued to pose a clear danger to the community, who happened to have a lot of money, could be out on bail, and those who committed minor nonviolent offenses would be behind bars because they can't afford to pay a minimum bail amount.
Yeah, Chris Christie's essay is actually points out a very bizarre way that the criminal justice system works across the country, that when you are waiting for a trial, the decision about whether or not you are detained is frequently almost exclusively based on whether or not you have the money to pay bail. It's not based on the dangerousness. It's not based on the crime you committed. And that is the way our system works. And there's actually a new way where the Arnold Foundation just released this. It's called a risk assessment instrument, where it helps courts determine who's actually dangerous and who is not, and then you can implement that to figure out whether or not someone should be detained, which is, seems a much more sensible way to do it.
Thanks, Adam. Elizabeth in Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hello. My sister is a nurse practitioner. To maintain her certification, she needs to complete so many hours a year of community service. And what she does is, on Saturday morning, she does intake physicals for people arrested the night before, or the Thursday, or whatever are in held. And her observations are, number one, she's never seen so many malnutrition people in her life. And secondly, so many young people, young adults, that are now going to jail for marijuana possession, and she feels there needs to be a different group of rehab for that instead of just going to prison. And I'll take the answer off the phone. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. In a mind.
Sure. So, I mean, yeah, I think that there definitely needs to be a way to divert people who come in who don't really need to be going through the criminal justice system. And I think that what the caller has flagged is there are a lot of people who are being arrested who do not need to be prosecuted, convicted, and in prison, but instead need some sort of social service.
And thank you for the call. I just wanted to talk about the formation of the book for a moment, because you have such a variety of speakers here you asked to contribute essays. How did you pick all of these people?
So, you know, we were looking for people who were very prominent leaders, most of whom had not previously spoken out on the topic, and people who were known as kind of political leaders, as well as people who were experts. So we looked to governors, we looked to senators, we looked to, you know, again, national well-known people who had not previously said much. So, for example, Secretary Hillary Clinton's essay here was actually written in advance of her speech that she gave on mass incarceration and previewed her speech. And we have a lot of other people in here, including Scott Walker, for example. This is one of the first times he's spoken out on criminal justice in terms of wanting to reduce the incarcerated population. And so we've put together what we hope is a good example of how there are bipartisan voices across the country agreeing on the need to reduce mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm. And he spoke in his essay, I'm wondering if a lot of states do this, he talked about the problem-solving courts in an effort, he writes, to address tough issues presented by alcohol and drug addiction, domestic abuse, and mental illness. Offenders not only see their judge just once for sentencing, they have to return in front of the sentencing judge. Offenders face the type of scrutiny that, he writes, only eye-to-eye accountability affords. Successful outcomes for participants mean lower incarceration rates and potential cost savings for taxpayers. Is this a unique program in Wisconsin?
So, you know, drug courts are spreading throughout the country. They are one way to help reduce the population. Drug courts basically are where they set up a special system for adjudication for certain drug crimes, usually nonviolent, lower-level drug crimes. They offer treatment, and usually if you continue your treatment, they stay the proceedings, and so you don't advance to the trial stage. So you're able to, complete the treatment, and then the charges are either dismissed or they are put on hold, basically. And so a lot of courts and a lot of states have used drug courts. There are also things called veterans courts and reentry courts. I think they are a good step in moving away from the system of kind of automatic charge, conviction, prosecution. I don't think that they are a holistic solution. I mean, I think the solution really is why is prison even hanging over someone's head when it is such a low-level crime? But I do, I do think it's something moving in the right direction.
Jay in Shatek is next. Hello, Jay.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm driving through the beautiful hill country of western Wisconsin, so I might lose you. I just wanted to kind of piggyback on what the lady said earlier about crime rates being tied to literacy or lack thereof. And while I don't disagree with that, I do bristle a little bit when I hear that, you know, it's got to be addressed in our schools. And, you know, we hear that in Wisconsin. I've been a teacher for 25 years, and I've, you know, we've addressed things in our schools to the point that we are parenting these kids. And that brings me to my point that really the root, in my opinion, is poor parenting. And, I can, most teachers would agree, I think, that we can see these kids in our classrooms and almost pick out who's going to end up in the criminal justice system at some point. And 99 times out of 100, their parents are either absentee or are just doing a horrible job. I get sick and tired of hearing. I mean, we have done things in our schools to the point where we're testing constantly and we're doing all these things, and yet it's still not enough when really the root of the problem is at home.
So I think that is flagging a very interesting dynamic. So a lot of times parents who are incarcerated, it actually dramatically decreases the chance of their children being incarcerated. So quite often some parents are absentee, where you'll have, particularly in urban communities, a father who's been in and out of prison, a mother who is working several jobs, and then you have young kids who don't necessarily have the supervision of both parents, because one is in prison and the other one is frequently working. And then you have kids kind of getting into trouble and then ending up in the system and then, you know, becoming kind of advancing in criminality and then themselves ending up in prison. I think the solution is, you know, obviously not only the policies, but to the extent that if we are reducing incarceration policies, there will be able to be more parents at home to make sure that their own children don't end up in the cycle.
We're going to continue taking your phone calls and our conversation with Inamai Chetiar. She is the director of the Brennan Center's Justice Program. The program seeks to secure our nation's promise of equal justice for all by creating an effective, rational, and fair legal system. We're talking about the compilation of essays found in the just-released book, Solutions, American Leaders Speak Out on Criminal Justice. They invited people who, some are well-known with concerns about criminal justice and their policies that they have called for or enacted in the case of some of these leaders. Others we haven't heard from as much. They are from all political persuasions. And what's interesting about the book is that on this particular issue, you can find widespread agreement that we have to change our policy of mass incarceration. What do you think? More phone calls. We have one line open. We've been really busy, but there's a line open for you, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. We'll get to an email and Facebook comment in a moment. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, more phone calls for our guest this hour, and our phone number again, 800-486-8655. Let's go to a Facebook comment here from Christopher, who says, there seems to be no discussion of crime prevention. This is where the work begins.
So I think that is a great point. What I would actually point you to is Kathy Lanier's essay. So she is the police chief of Washington, D.C., and she actually tells a very interesting story there where I'm sure that, you know, you and your callers remember, but at some point, D.C. was the murder capital of the world. And she talks about how they tried zero-tolerance policing, and they tried some of these other aggressive policing tactics, and that it actually did not do anything to bring down crime, and that they then shifted their policing policies to focus on not only community policing but also crime prevention. And so they melded both of these types of strategies together, and they actually brought down the murder rate in D.C. And so that essay speaks very, very specifically about crime prevention. There's actually a whole wave of law enforcement that has been talking about the need to focus on crime prevention as opposed to merely just enforcing, you know, the laws after people have already broken them.
Bill is next in Managua. Hold on a second, Bill. There we go. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just wanted to comment on the environmental factor. I'm in law enforcement, and when we make contact with people, for one reason or another, you know, I think the majority of officers got into the business to help people. That was their answer to that question when they first started. And one of the biggest challenges is we're out there attempting to help them enforce the law the best we can. And these people we have contact with, a lot of them are younger. They get placed back in the same environment. And it almost feels like they don't have a chance. They have opportunities, but it's culturally or within their family or local environment, they're really not even encouraged to try and aspire to do better.
I'm sure there are myriad reasons here, but is there a common reason why you're arresting the young people? Is it drug offenses, Bill, or something else?
You know, we have a lot of prescription drug and regular recreational drugs. We have a lot of drinking, underage drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And normally something will bring us to have contact with them, a traffic accident, a complaint from a neighbor, you know, something, a traffic complaint. And once you're in contact with them, you know, we do the best to enforce what we can, and they do get pulled into the system. They end up going into court, and you know they're committing violations that maybe 20 years ago, 18 to 25 year olds were doing. Now it's 13, 14, and 15 year olds.
Oh. And where do they go once they get into the system? Where do they go?
Well, the minors will be referred to juvenile court, and then they go through the court systems, and you know through probation or some of the juvenile. More like a juvenile probation will monitor them and give them conditions that they have to follow, and they basically have to behave for a period of time and show that, you know, they've corrected the behavior.
And when they go home, what do you worry about?
We take them home, we drop them off, and they're in the same environment. The parent, you know, the maybe they're getting these behaviors, they're learning them from the parents, and we're familiar with the parents as well.
Mm.
And the other comment I had is, I think you would have to look really hard to find officers who really don't care about the people they're serving. I think it's very important, and a lot of times I think they're sold out as a tool that, you know, maybe enforcement uses, and we're really out there to help the communities. I think that's really important.
Thank you for your call, Bill. Inamai.
Yeah, you know, I think that particularly the comments about the juvenile justice system, I think, are particularly important there. So, you know, we've for now been talking about adult mass incarceration and the number of adults being incarcerated, but what is an equal, perhaps, if not greater problem is the juvenile justice system, where we have so many children also going through the system and very, you know, small school discipline crimes that can land children into prison. And, you know, I think that that's a really important point to also be flagging, that this occurs very, very, to very young children, and that this can not only affect them, but also obviously increase the likelihood of them ending up in the system when they're adults.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Bill. I'm glad you called. Shirley Waukesha. Hi.
Hello. Hello.
Hi, Shirley.
I'm a member of SOFIA, which is a part of a statewide organization called Wisdom. And I was surprised to hear that Scott Walker has come out in favor of reducing the prison population. Our organization has had as many as 1,000 people go to Madison to meet with legislators, and there's no one who will agree from the governor's office to meet with us. So I just question his statement.
What are you calling for? What is your group calling for as a way to reduce the population?
Well, we had a goal of 11 by 15, cutting the nonviolent, mentally ill prison population by half in 2015. And there's been absolutely no response to that from the governor or his staff.
Nobody's met with you?
No.
Inamai, if you're going to affect change, if you have groups calling for change, are most people in government responsive to listening to ideas, or is there still a lot of political turmoil over this issue?
Yeah, you know, I think that Scott Walker's essay and Scott Walker's track record on criminal justice is actually quite interesting, because he is he's not as progressive on the issue as some of the other folks in the book. However, he still talks about that he believes that we can reduce crime and drug addiction while not necessitating mass incarceration. So he seems to me, you know, someone who has had a very law and order, kind of tough on crime history, but is now kind of agreeing with the consensus that we can reduce our incarceration rate, but, you know, obviously not going as far as somebody like Rand Paul or Cory Booker or some of the other folks who are a little bit more progressive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess all you can do is keep knocking on the door, Shirley.
Yeah, I mean, so his essay in the book is actually one of his only statements on criminal justice in the last year or so. And I think it shows, you know, a little bit of an obvious recognition that we don't need mass incarceration, but, you know, still obviously, you know, someone who supports very strong crime policies.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for having compiled this book. It's just very interesting. It's interesting you picked a variety of people, and people you normally wouldn't think would be responding to criminal justice essays. And what struck me was the consensus on certain issues. It's very telling and rather remarkable, I'd say. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It is quite remarkable that in this day and age, politicians from so many different sides of the aisle are agreeing on an issue. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Inamai Chettiar, our guest, she is director of the Brennan Center's Justice Program. The book is a series of essays by 22 leaders, and it is titled Solutions, American Leaders Speak Out on Criminal Justice. It's just been released, and everybody in the book agrees that there are too many people who are in prison. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up, and then we'll start a celebration of the 4th of July with Christopher Phillips.